did request it many months ago. So what I want to talk about, first of all, thanks. I appreciate the opportunity to be here and talk to you today. What I want to talk about is something you're all familiar with conceptually, which is correcting model error. But you may not immediately appreciate the model error I'm talking about. I'm talking about this one. A lot of problems arise because we believe the Earth is a sphere. Well, if you can get over that and think of the Earth as a cube, a lot of problems go away. And new problems arise, but they're very tractable. This is a slide you've seen before, just to kind of remind you of what many of you have seen before. You can project the sphere to the cube. There's my phaser. You can project the sphere to the cube. So here I'm pointing out the edges of a cube projected onto the sphere. And then you can subdivide the cube faces. So if I subdivide by 4, I have this kind of mesh here. And then subdivide again. Here I have 8 on each cube face, 8 on each cube edge, so 64 elements on each cube edge, and so on. You get a nice refined mesh on your sphere. And these are spectral elements that several speakers have already talked about and several of you are already using. But notice they're quadrangles. And it's very important to use quadrangles because you have tensor product faces. So on each element, I have a local sort of XY coordinate system. It's actually not orthogonal. But then you can use polynomial quadrature and get very high accuracy. So that's the one of the main reasons to go to the cube. Some of you have seen this slide. This is just another motivating slide of the for using such a method. Our just performance results I got with the spectral element atmosphere model, which was mainly created by Mark Taylor and then also worked on by myself. So this just shows the heavy curves that are easy to see are the performance per processor, megaflops up to 220 megaflops on roughly up to 32 processors, and the gigaflops total for overall processors up to about 130 gigaflops on 1,024 processors. And for various sort of computer science reasons, the method that the spectral element model employs allows this performance. And these results are already a year or two old, and I must point out that Steve Thomas and Rich Loft have maybe a factor of 2 better or 3 better with this year with their recoding of the model. So history aside, let me tell you what I've been working on off and on lately. I apologize for the lack of generality of this figure, but you notice I've got sort of a adaptive mesh here for some slightly interesting function. What I did is I took the Stroker harmonic with degree 2, order 2, which is all you Stroker harmonic buffs know is some kind of a sort of smoothly bumping function on the sphere, and then I rotated it by 25 degrees around the axis through 0,90. And I've got a few experiments like this, but this is the one I printed out. Just to show that if I have a bump, which on a workstation is a nice sort of purplish thing here, but now it's kind of pink. If I have a bump that rotates across, here's my original cube edge, then I have a method for subdividing adaptively, which I'm going to explain next. And so where the bump is, there are more elements. And since the bump is pretty broad, there isn't very impressive refinement locally. But nevertheless, the algorithm adaptively refines to the bump, which is here. There are actually bumps with sort of a cubic symmetry on this function. So only these patches are left. But you can see it's asymmetric. But the reason I wanted to show you an asymmetric one was because the issue then becomes, if I want to have operators, I have to have a method for applying operators across these kinds of, sometimes they're called hanging nodes, although it's not exactly appropriate in this in this description. But I need to have a way to do that and to do it with high accuracy and high order. So this, again, is to sort of motivate the following. Okay, so since several speakers have talked about spectral elements already, I'm going to assume some basic idea and just kind of get you to look at them in a new way. So here I'm showing you one element in one dimension, and the little blue nodes are the nodes associated with that red curve, which is the quadrature, which is the cardinal function. And then the function is labeled by its node, 1, since I have 0, 1, 2, 3 nodes. And then it's labeled by its degree, 3. So this is obviously a cubic, or it would be if I used a computer to draw it. And then it's labeled now by its interval. So that's also sort of a new kind of label. It's what interval does it live on? But as you know, when you do H refinement, then the space of test functions or trial functions is refined to a larger space. So now I can copy this function here, the lower left and lower right, and I have the interval 0, 1/2, and 1/2, 1. And then these two functions are sort of skinnier copies of that function. And there's a space which is sort of the union of the two skinnier spaces. And that space has the property that all functions refined, all functions confined to the intervals are cubics. And now you just have to sort of have a moment of revelation where you say, hey, if a function is a cubic on one interval and it's a cubic on the other interval, in the special circumstance that it's the same cubic on both intervals, then it actually belongs to this space. In other words, all functions which are in this space are special cases of functions in the lower space. Therefore, they're nested. So if we go to the bottom, we get that the functions in the smaller space constitute a subspace of the functions in the finer space. And if I continue doing H refinement, as indicated by the first picture of all the smaller and smaller elements, this is a so-called multi-resolution ladder, hopefully for obvious reasons by now. And then formally, the basis functions in the coarser space, the smoother space, if you like, the space of bigger things, is some linear combination of the basis functions in the finer space. And then these coefficients are called H. They're actually matrices. They're matrices whose rank corresponds to the number of quadrature nodes. And so this linear combination formally has the same structure as the so-called scaling equation when you do a wavelet multi-resolution analysis. So this summarizes the premise of the work I'll cite on the next slide. If you want all the gory details, you can look at this paper from Alpert, Belkin, Jines, and Vazovoy from 99, which I don't have the exact URL, but if you go to mine, it's easy to find. Okay. So now I want to give you some flavor of the next step, which is being able to compute the derivatives. So excuse me for having a lot of math because, you know, there was this adaptive methods workshop and I thought they wanted to see a lot of math. But anyway, I'm going to just sort of give you the highlights of this slide here. Does it work to use this pointer, or should I like use a real thing of a shadow? Would that be better? Because I can't see it from back there. But okay, so you know there's these cardinal functions which are defined as interpolating polynomials. That's this product expression here. And so I can take the span of these functions, and I get my space for any polynomial degree, which I'll fix. And then I can apply H refinement and get my ladder. And so now, for simplicity, I'm just indexing by how small the smallest element is. So now I have some space VHP. And hence you have HP refinement, although I'm not going to do any P refinement, although it's possible. Then the global functions are down here. The global functions are just defined to be rescaled values of the original function. So I have now a scale L, so that the larger L is, the smaller the function is. And I have a location K, and K locates the function. So think of any of these meshes, and you can do this in any dimension. K is going to say, which element am I in? And L is going to say, how big is that element? OK, but the formalism is important in order for things to actually work and get orthonormal bases and that kind of stuff. OK, so I said highlights. So I want to talk about adaptive refinement now. So adaptive refinement is just says, again, I have, you know, some space of functions, but now I'm going to restrict their locations depending on how big the elements are. And so probably the easiest thing to do is just look at the picture at the bottom. Forgetting the notation, I have some sets of intervals, and if I have the smallest interval being 1/4, then the possibilities are that they're all 1/4, or two of them are 1/4 here, or the other two on the left are 1/4, and otherwise they're bigger or smaller. So those are the possible spaces for a given smallest scale. Okay. So as I said, if you do it this way, notice implicitly I've been using Gauss nodes, not Gauss-Lobato nodes. The reason for that is I need to have the dimensions of my subspaces go exactly by half. If I use Gauss-Lobato nodes and the nodes are on the boundaries, then when I divide by 2, the constraint of continuity wrecks the whole subspace property. Given that I don't do that and keep Gauss nodes, then I get a nice orthonormal basis. And I think it's interesting that we don't usually talk about it that way, but in fact it's orthonormal. With respect to how big the elements are, with respect to where the elements are, and with respect to which node of the quadrature you're in. So this orthonormality is very nice for constructing operators. And then there's a constraint, of course, that I don't cover any point in the domain twice, and don't leave any points uncovered. So that's some constraint on how many, you know, it has to be complete in some sense. Okay. So now you should be wondering, well, if he's not using Gauss-Lobato nodes, what's going to happen to his continuity and stuff? Let me, the middle section here is just about notation. I mean, the value of a function at a certain mapped point gives you a coefficient in an expansion, basically. And then these matrices I mentioned before can be used to give you the coarse scale components as linear combinations of the fine scale components. So it's all the same kind of wavelet stuff that you may have seen. But it's basically filtering operations. Coarsening or smoothing as a filtering operation. Okay, so I can build this, very quickly build this whole multi-resolution. But now the interesting thing, and you really don't have to look at all the blinding details, but basically I have an operator, del by del x, and I'm going to project it using some projections. Projection operator is just defined. And then this is what you're doing all the time in any kind of, you know, Galerkin-type method. But now you sort of massage it, and so leaving out the details, you massage it so that these points, the Lobato points that I'm not using in my representation, are actually accounted for. And when you do that, then down at the bottom you have the values of your basis functions at 0 and 1. All the rescaling has been pulled out. And since I'm trying to compute the derivative using functions which are discontinuous, I can only, at best, get a weak representation. So when I do that, I pull out the weak representation here. So here's basis function, derivative, basis function. But then I have coefficients, which depend on the values of the basis functions, which can be computed. But then I have free parameters, two free parameters. So there's weights, 1 minus A0 and A0, and 1 minus A1 and A1. So these free parameters just arise from the formalism of constructing the operator. But they allow you to take care of the continuity when you apply the derivative. They also allow you to take care of boundary conditions, which is not a concern on the sphere, but you know, you could construct problems where it is an issue. This is just an estimate of the error in the derivative. And what's interesting about that for some is that you can choose your free parameters to cancel out the leading term in the error, which is what we do because, again, we don't have to worry about boundary conditions. And so here's our operator, the derivative operator. The block bit is the usual weak form of the derivative plus the boundary correction. And that's going to be a block because all these little underscored things are vectors. And so I have little blocks here constructed by outer products. And then the whole operator will have a block diagonal structure. And then the tri-diagonal part, the blue part, will be rank 1 because it's just one outer product here. And so the cost that you pay in having this rank 1 tri-diagonal is formally the same cost you pay in imposing continuity when you do the stiffness summation, because you have to connect all your elements using continuity imposition. That's also a rank 1 tri-diagonal operation. You just don't do it that way. And then everything else is 0. Okay. The green discussion at the bottom is just what I said. Now, since I'm going to be doing adaptivity, I should say briefly how I do that. And often when I explain this, I get asked, where are the multi-wavelets? So as I said, there are these subspace relationships between spaces of a given scale and spaces of the finer scale. Therefore, I can let the finer space be an orthogonal sum. And so the W, which has the same dimension as the V because of construction, is another subspace of the finer space. And you can find filters G, which are of the same rank as the quadrature, such that this operation on the fine basis functions gives you basis functions for W. And they're the so-called multi-wavelets, multi because they've got this extra degree of freedom for the quadrature. And you get this nice orthogonal matrix with the H's and G's. And so a lot of transforms and things are done quickly and easily invertible. But what I want you to briefly attend to is this bottom line. If I take my coefficients and I operate on them with these G filters, basically I'm filtering out now a high pass and looking at the detail in those coefficients. And then I can compare that to some measure of the overall function norm and some predetermined or desired accuracy epsilon. And you have a nice property that only works in multi-resolution analysis. It wouldn't work in Fourier analysis. That if this is true, if this detail energy, I'm taking the L2 norm here, is bounded by epsilon with this normalization, then you can show that the overall construction is also bounded order epsilon. This is a theorem which guarantees that you can do this kind of refinement using the refinement criterion, this L2 energy of this sort of high-pass filtering operation. Okay, so without further ado, that's how you get the different size elements covering whatever your original function was. Now, when I compute a differential equation, you just do the same thing at every time step, and you could complify this as much as you want, but you can adapt the state that you're computing to its own local smoothness or local variability. So I've got a slide here about how time stepping is done. Let me just, without details, tell you that we're using actually exponential propagation. So I've got some equation with a linear part and a nonlinear part. Formally, I can write that as an integral equation with exponential operators. So if I can compute the exponential of an operator, then this is a very efficient time-stepping scheme, because all I do then is do quadrature and time. It's unconditionally stable and all kinds of nice stuff like that. It's not always easy to compute exponential operators. A nice example is in doing the Fourier transform, you diagonalize L. We don't want to diagonalize. We want to use some kind of sparse structure. But leaving details aside, let's just say that I can do something called scaling and squaring. And the idea there is I just scale the whole operator by some 2 to the j, then do something like a Taylor series. It's not exactly a Taylor series. I mean, this is a Taylor series, but what we really do isn't a Taylor series. And then square it j times. Then I get back the exponential operator, and then similarly I get coefficients in some kind of an implicit time-stepping scheme. So there's an implicit scheme we're using. I think I'll skip the details. Okay, so bringing us up to results, the last ingredient that I haven't quite incorporated yet, so you won't see it in the results, but I want to mention it, is how to apply high-order operators on the sphere. Sorry, cube. So here I've drawn a cube in black, this little cartoon here, and then I've got three loops around it. So there's a green I loop, a blue J loop, and a black K loop. And each loop goes around four faces, and each loop has one direction on each of the four faces, so 3 times 4 is 12, which is the same as 2 directions times 6 faces. So you can get all the information on the cube either by counting faces and taking 2 directions on each face, kind of like this, or you can take your 3 loops around the cube. The advantage of taking the 3 loops is that if I have a high-order operator, which is now going to look at elements extending off of my cube faces, so say I'm doing something, instead of doing nearest neighbors, I'm going to go over my cube face one way or the other way, it's much easier to construct the operator using something which is closer to a periodic coordinate system. And those of you who've tried to do finite difference methods and have big stencils know that this is complicated if you just try to do it brute force. This one's kind of fun. Maybe I can't spend too much time on it. This is just a way of picturing. This is what I'm doodling with. If you see me doodling, this is what I'm doing. Trying to figure out how to make a picture of the cube where my different colored coordinate systems will always be right-handed and always periodically, here's the blue one going around, here's the green one. It's the same thing I just showed in the previous slide, but drawn flat, so you can actually program it. Okay, so let me just leave that out and show some results. I'm happy to talk about this if anyone is interested. Afterwards, Berger's equation. So at the bottom, I have an initial condition, which is a sine wave. I have a combination of diffusion and nonlinear advection. And so as time evolves, I move upwards. And these pictures and the sine wave evolves into a sawtooth wave. And what I've plotted are the representations on the elements down here at the bottom of my quadrature nodes initially. But as the elements or as the solution sharpens here, my algorithm automatically refines the 1D mesh, and so I can have more and more elements and refine this shock very accurately. So meteorologists take note that if you wanted to, you know, predict a front or something, this would be a good way to do it. Yes, sir? If you write down a function for me, I can integrate it and tell you what happens, but I'm not sure. Moving. Okay, since you mentioned moving, you anticipated the next slide, which is here's an initial condition, which is under the same operator will evolve into a moving front, and then you just have to say the magic word. And the algorithm builds refined elements where the front is, and then it deconstructs them in the back, so because you don't need them anymore. So that's also useful. What do I get, 5? Okay, no problem. I'm just showing the last couple of slides here. This is just a test function. I should write John Boyd on this because I got out of his book, which you can get from his website or from Dover. And this is called, John named it the symmetric imbricated Lorentzian. I won't even tell you why, but it's a nice function for tests because there's one parameter, or in two dimensions, two parameters, which control its width, and therefore, well, not therefore, but you can adjust those parameters to get any local variation you want while maintaining a periodic function. And then, so it can be a delta function or it can be a flat function. And here it's the sort of some, you know, bump under the sheets function. And it's totally periodic. And you can see the refinement here, where it's flat, there's 1/4 size elements. Then as it grows, there's 1/8 size. And then as it gets really sharp, there's 1/16 size. So that's to get us into two dimensions gradually. And this is where I wanted two projectors, but let me rely on the image on your retina. Here's a sine wave in two dimensions. So I'm going to take the sine wave, which is now just like a 1D sine wave. I've just rotated it along the 45-degree line and applied the algorithm. So I'm going to hit this with Berger's equation in 2D. But first, I'll show you the mesh. So where there's 1/8 size elements, that corresponds to where the sine wave is locally quadratic. And where there's 1/4 size, it's where it's locally linear. And so that's the adaptive mesh for the initial condition. I hit it with exponential propagators, take a few time steps. It's starting to fold up a little bit. I'm just showing you the time steps when it changed representation. So now, where it's folding up, I've lost those 1/4 elements I've refined. Notice the elements are discontinuous, but the operators don't care. Or they do care, I should say, but they just deal with it. Last two slides, well, almost. The really sharpening up now, so now it's almost at a sawtooth. Okay, this is the last two slides. There's the refinement again. I've got smaller elements down to the 1/16 size, but just over the front. And I just did a quick future plan slide, since the conclusions would just be that this is work in progress, obviously, but it's a method with a very firm foundation for doing adaptive computations of nonlinear PDEs. Future plans, I have to mention multi-resolution based on prolate spheroidal wave functions, just again because John gave us such a nice introduction to them the other day. So this is work based on my colleagues, Greg Belkin and Monzon. If you look in the abstract volume, the names of other colleagues, especially Vani Chiruvu, did a lot of the coding, really most of the coding. Then another property called approximate separation of variables, and I didn't really have time to get into this, but you know, as you go into higher dimensions, there's an exponential growth with number of dimensions in the complexity of a lot of algorithms. And what Belkin and Mollenkamp worked out was a way to take any function or any operator and write it as a sum of separated functions plus some error, or as a sum, this sigma should be some kind of orthogonal plus symbol or something, but anyway, as a sum of separated operators. And there's no sort of general known best way to do this, but they have a way to do it, and they can control the error in doing so. And once you do that, then all your algorithms become a lot easier because you just have separated operations in each direction. Instead of having exponential growth with dimension, you have linear growth with dimension. And that means you can do more resolution at in two dimensions or three dimensions even than you could have before. Thanks for your attention. Frank. I don't understand water elements well enough. And what I do understand, you see, there is an imposition of continuity, which is what I think water elements do in another way. So I would have to, you know, go to the blackboard of somebody that understands water elements, perhaps yourself, and hash out the details and see if it's the same thing. Because, I mean, would you say discontinuous Galerkin is the same? Because I don't know if it's more like discontinuous Galerkin.
Right. Yeah, that's a good question. This obviously seems a lot more elegant than.
Thank you. But I can't take the credit for it. It goes to Alpert, Belkin, Jones, and Vazovoy. I made it much clearer. Yes, Jorn. Yeah, yeah.
Okay. So you showed this Borges equation in two dimensions, and as far as I understood it, it was within artificial
well. That's what Borges equation is, yeah. Yeah.
Could you apply this method also to non-logistic?
No, that's an interesting point. The whole basis of the method, which I kind of quickly skimmed over, was I need to have an exponential propagator, which most conveniently is a negative definite operator, I mean, which I exponentiate, and therefore I get a nice converging propagator. If you have only non-negative definite stuff, like for instance, when I did some experiments with a rotating 1D system in which the linear terms have a non-signed definite part, and I kept those in the non-linear part because you want that you're exponentiating something which has this negative definite spectrum. If you're exponentiating something which has imaginary eigenvalues, say, then you get oscillations instead of a nice, it just doesn't work as well. So it gets complicated. We haven't done a problem. We have a theory for it, but we haven't done that. So the bottom line would be, as physicists, we just say, well, there's always some diffusion, but you can make it very small. In fact, the smaller you make it, the faster the theories defining the operator will converge. So we can do a very high Reynolds number, I think I showed in the 1D Borges case. Now, about refinement, I'm looking for that. I'm getting close to it. Here we go. That goes back to this slide. So what this says is, suppose I've got two elements, and their indexes are 2k and 2k plus 1, so they're neighbors. And then I want to know, do I need to keep them or can I merge them? So I've got those two elements, and they're both on scale L plus 1. If I merge them, they're gone, and I have only scale L, so I have a fatter scale. So in order to compute that necessity, I apply these filters. So there's a G0 for the 2k and a G1 for the 2k plus 1. And then that sum represents the energy in a band in some sense. It's very rigorously the energy in the band, just the way if you do Fourier analysis, you have a band, but it's the energy in a band which is localized in space. And so there's actually what some people call a phase-space decomposition because you have like little Fourier analysis in every element. There's more details to make that really a rigorous statement, but let me leave it at that. So once I do that, I can compare that to epsilon and normalized by my scale and the norm of the function, which is typically order 1. And then, as I said, if you take this quantity, which is the projection onto the scale L, and you do telescopic series and triangle inequality and all that fun stuff, you can show that it's bounded. And so you're guaranteed, if this quantity is less than that and you set it to 0, you're guaranteed that the overall function error will be bounded that way. Yes. Yeah. You can do it in every, in 1D pair of elements, in 2D quad of elements, et cetera. Todd?
I think I'm missing something very basic here. You mentioned about having to reach off of elements to compute your derivative, basically, to compute your operator.
Yeah. Right.
So why would you ever
have to reach a cross? So it's a reformulation in which you don't use the Gauss-Lobato points. And so because you've given those up, you need to impose continuity some other way.
Okay, there's different
things. Well, we see our concept, which empirically is working, is that if your initial condition is smooth, the only thing that's going to kill it is applying a derivative. So we build the continuity into the derivative operator because that's the only place you need it. And so far, that's worked. Mm-hmm. That's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wouldn't get a vortex. I mean, we're sort of going in steps, and so Berger seemed like the first 2D problem, although I think another interesting problem I thought of while I was here was to do a 2D heat equation with a time-dependent linear advection term. Because then I could like move waves around while they're decaying. So that's a question of you know building algorithms and adding one level of complexity at a time. But an easy thing to do would be to use this as an initial condition, and I've played around with what that would do. I mean, basically the advection is along the gradient of your function. So I would have a u and v component in two dimensions, and then this would do something interesting. It might. The parts of it that are appropriately inclined would form shocks in one direction, and the parts that go the other way would do something else. And so, stay tuned. Maybe I'll get that done by 18 months from now.